Good morning, everyone. As we continue exploring some of the challenging words that we find in the Old Testament prophets, we often feature in some of our readings, but we don't often spend as much time to dwell on how they continue to speak to us today. The Old Testament prophets were very rarely, if ever, popular, because they had messages that disturbed, left people feeling uncomfortable, if not quite angry at some of the things that are said. But they are significant parts of the way in which God seeks to correct, to guide, to instruct, and to call back his people across the ages. So today we're looking at Jeremiah, and which we had introduced last week, and just an early part, a sample of Jeremiah's prophetic message that follows. You might recall about a month ago I had a sermon where I confessed at the start of the sermon I wasn't quite sure how I was going to finish it. I wasn't quite sure where I was going to land with it. This is different this time round. I know exactly where I want to land it. I just got to get there. But I know where my destination is that I want to get. One of the slides I did use about a month ago in introducing the role of the prophets, I quoted from this Polish-Jewish rabbi, Abraham Joshua Heschel. And I've since come back to a number of sections of his book. I haven't read the whole book on the prophets and found it incredibly helpful. In one of the sections, he describes the role of the prophet. The prophet's task is to convey a divine pathos. He lives not only his personal life, but also the life of God. The prophet hears God's voice and feels his heart. I found that it's such a helpful way of what to look out for. And that certainly features in the passage we've just heard from Jeremiah. So in this passage in Jeremiah, we have what is formally called a divine lawsuit. That is to say, God summons the heavens to hear a charge that he brings against his people, Judah. I will bring my case against you, says the Lord. I will even bring charges against your children's children in the years to come. So it's a dramatic scene, and you could picture it in the sense of we've been brought in and we're about to hear the opening pleading of the case against the charges are brought against Judah, and the children's children of Judah for years to come. And the charges are a pretty strong indictment. First starts with a rhetorical question. What did your ancestors find wrong with me that led them to stray so far from me? They worshipped worthless idols, only to become worthless themselves. So you have a figure, and it's, if I can convey it in a sense of perhaps in a more familiar terms that we might be, may call to mind, maybe not. But if you know what it's like as a parent sometimes when you spend the many hours nurturing, raising children, babies, caring for them, all the nappy changes, all the getting up in the night, all the walking around to try and soothe, all those years. You survive all through the tantrum years when they're running off in directions and having meltdowns in the supermarket because they can't have the chocolate or whatever they've seen. And you deal with all the embarrassment of having to try and deal with them. You get them right through into the teenage years, and you're sort of there for them, all the angst of the preteen stages of the friends who's no longer my best friend and now is my number two best friend and all the different angst that goes through that. And then you get them to their teenage years. You think, oh, we've got through all that. And then you have that experience with teenagers where you ask them to do something, and it's as if you're not even in the room. Ever had that experience? Yeah. Hello, I'm here. Or you get the more common response, which is sure, yeah, yeah, which is basically short for whatever. No, I'm not going to do it anyway, but I'll just say it. How do you feel in those moments? You think, we've given so much to raising you and caring for you and nurturing you and have been there for you for all the tears and the cries, and now you're just ignoring me. You wouldn't just say, look, this is not a very correct approach. You'd actually feel response of saying, you're not respecting that. You're not respecting our relationship. And that's in a sort of small form of how Yahweh feels with Israel. He says, I heard your cries in Egypt. I brought you out of slavery. I took you through the wilderness years. I took you through the years of the deserts. Yeah. That is such a beautiful phrase. I've used it often myself. God says, I've been there for you. What did your ancestors find wrong with that that led them to stray so far from me? So it's a response that we can feel. And as Jeremiah lays it out, gives words to Yahweh's complaint and response, he says the entire system is corrupt and guilty of idolatry. The leaders have failed, the priests, the rulers, the teachers, and the prophets. It's all part of this charge sheet. The leaders did not ask, where is the Lord who brought us safely out of Egypt? What he meant was, we are facing a threat. We are facing peril. The leaders didn't say, oh, let's turn to the God who has been there for us in the past and has a pretty good track record of bringing us salvation against threat. They didn't even think of that. They went after other nations to try and do security deals. The priest didn't ask in the time of crisis, let's gather together and pray to God. They didn't say, where is God in this? Let's turn to God. They were pointing elsewhere. Those who taught my word, the teachers, ignored me, and the rulers turned against me. The prophets spoke in the name of Baal, wasting their time on worthless idols. God is saying, what have I done wrong that you have responded in these ways? Now, we can spend a little time. I'm not going to go into it in detail. The circumstances is probably based around the threats that Judah was experiencing. You might remember how Assyria had come in and had overwhelmed the north and taken up the 10.5 tribes of what was known as the Northern Kingdom at that stage, and they were feeling threatened. And as they were turning to their leaders and saying, what do we do? How can we avoid this same threat? The leaders were saying, well, perhaps we should have a treaty with Egypt, or maybe we should do a treaty with Assyria and try and do some form of trade. That's where they were turning for their security. I'm not going to dwell on that background, but you can see how God continues. Has any nation ever traded its gods for new ones, even though they were not gods at all? I said, why are you turning after other gods? Why would a nation say, yeah, God of Israel has been there. He established us. He brought us through out of slavery. He brought us through all the threats and settled us and has given us this land. Why would we now say, oh, we can do without that God and turn to another God? Other nations don't do that. Yet my people have exchanged their glorious God for worthless idols. Taking a step back from the circumstances of Judah at that stage, a significant question for us to settle with, and I'm not going to dwell on it in detail, is whom or what do you worship? Whom or what do you worship? And even though we don't necessarily go out and have the idols, like the Baal idols and others that Israel were looking at, and not even necessarily other idols that are available in our wider global community, but idols are things that we regard as of greatest worth. In fact, the word worship in English is a contraction of the word worth-ship, that which we contribute the greatest worth to, we value the most. And that becomes a challenging question of what actually is most important to me in my day-to-day living, in the way in which I shape my life and my ambitions, my hopes, my security, my sense of meaning, my sense of value. That becomes a question for all times and all places. So the verdict that is given, for my people have done two evil things. They have abandoned me, the fountain of living water, and they have dug for themselves cracked cisterns that can no longer hold no water at all. Here we need to note that it isn't just a court scene that's been played out here. There is a break in relationship. God's heart is revealed in these words. It isn't just a legal case. This is the cry of a wounded and heartbroken lover. In fact, that language is there already in verse 2, just before our section in Jeremiah. Remember how eager you were to please me as a young bride long ago, speaking of Judah as the bride of God. How you loved me and followed me even through the barren wilderness. This is a painful breakup in a relationship that we have played before us. A couple of quotes in this regard. The lawsuit highlights justice, but the tone reveals grief. What did your ancestors find wrong in me that you would stray so far from me? Revisiting that circumstances that you may or may not have had as parenting or grandparenting or whenever you have observed that sort of space, you know how hard it is sometimes when you want to reason with children or grandchildren and others, what they're doing is unreasonable. But it's much more than that. There's actually a pain in that sentiment. Why would you be turning away from me? And all the angst that goes with that. Another quote from Abraham Herschel on this particular passage. God is moved and affected by what happens in the world. And in Jeremiah, the Lord is a suffering being, grieved by the betrayal of his people. Sometimes we have this caricature of God up in the heavens as a God of judgment who's just dashing out punishment and anger in all different directions. But of all the prophets, Jeremiah is regarded as the one strongest in that language of judgment. We have a language of pain. God in pain. God in grief. I found that a really helpful, incisive insight into how we respond to things that we look in the world around us that cause us anger at things that are not right. But actually God hears and feels that injustice and the hurt and the grief shouldn't be this way. And that is what moves God to action. Another quote from someone that we often do quote in our sermons, Walter Brueggemann, the Old Testament scholar who died about 3 or 4 months ago. On this passage, he says, "The legal form of the lawsuit cannot contain the emotional intensity of the speech. What we hear is not a cold brief against Israel, but the wounded voice of Yahweh, bereft of the partner whose devotion once gave joy." Isn't that sense of missing the moments we had, we shared together, the delights, the joys, the journeys through it, is suddenly separated. And that is causing God grief in that space. Just one other quote from someone else I found really helpful on this, Kathleen O'Connor. "We start with an image of formal judgment, but we're left an expression of God's sorrow and grief." And this is how Kathleen O'Connor puts it. "The shocking indictment is not merely that they broke commandments, but they abandoned a relationship of love and fidelity. The people turned away from the one who sustained them, and in doing so, they betrayed the very source of their existence." At this point, when I was reflecting, I can see how that speaks to the people of Judah and their break in that relationship, their covenant relationship with Yahweh in those circumstances, and the folly of them saying they're better off doing deals with Egypt or in Syria rather than looking to their own God who's got this track record of being there for them. But the challenge becomes, where do we go with that in our day? In our circumstances. Terence Fefferman, another Old Testament scholar, puts it this way: the image of living water contrasts sharply with the image of broken cisterns. Israel has exchanged a God of abundance, the streams, the springs that are giving forth, whose resources overflow, for a world of scarcity where no vessel can hold what is needed for life. At this point in my preparation, I could see how that does speak very much into our world today. And the phrase in particular, verse 13, they dug for themselves cracked cisterns that can hold no water at all. It was a sense of, we don't need God, we can do it ourselves. We can carve out our career, we can carve out our plan for how to have comfort, how to have security, and then discover that that plan that we have actually cannot hold the living water. Sometimes I remember at Mawson Lakes, and it is actually not quite a caricature, but Mawson Lakes, that Fiona and I lived in there for about 8 years or so, is an aspirational suburb. Beautifully laid out. You would never take a shortcut through Mawson Lakes, because you enter on one port and 20 minutes later you exit at the same point, having gone around and around in circles. That's the way they designed it. Lovely place to go. And we were, after 3 or 4 years, we were the old timers in our street. There's so much movement in and out. But you could almost see people literally having aspired to this home with the double garage and all the efficiencies that go with that area, sticking their head out the front door and saying, and now what? And now what? How do I have a sense of community, of life, of being part of something in this space? It is all too much in our own space. The broken systems, that image we'll come to in a minute, is any system, ideology, or practice that promises security and flourishing apart from God. What do we look for security and flourishing? And there is no shortage of messages and promises and narratives in the world around us promising security and flourishing, sometimes through a product, but other times through other things. The broken systems, Brueggemann suggests, of our time are the illusions of national security. It's interesting, he wrote this 10 years ago, before the rise of nationalism that is now becoming so rampant as this is what's going to give us security as a nation and economic prosperity. We have to put ourselves first. Economic growth and the technological advance that cannot finally quench our deep human thirst. I don't know about you, but I find on my Facebook page a whole stream of ads come up from these people who are saying, how can you be the smartest person in the room when you go to business meetings? You can do in 15 minutes what has taken all this time. And what do? You need to learn how to make AI work for you. All these promises that go with it. I haven't signed up, by the way, just in case you were wondering. Fefferman puts it this way: the broken systems, he suggests, are the economic systems that guarantee abundance but ignore justice, is to turn from the fountain of living water to cracked cisterns that cannot sustain life. If you put economic well-being and abundance ahead of justice, then you are embarking on a dangerous path. So where does this take us? Broken systems can mean any system, ideology, or practices that promises security and flourishing apart from God. Kathleen O'Connor puts it in this way: it's the modern obsessions with acquisition, consumption, and productivity as sources of meaning. It is not saying those things are bad in and of themselves, but if we invest our hope, our sense of meaning in that, then we are in dangerous territory. So how am I going to land this sermon? This is speaking to myself. Reminded the gospel promise of fresh, sustaining, life-giving water. It's revisited in Jeremiah, it's there in Isaiah, it's there in the Gospel of John. Come to me, the living water. Remember the promise of Jesus speaking with the Samaritan woman. And that image is the promise that God is the one who gives life and can sustain life. And anything that ignores that is in dangerous territory. And to be reminded, not just of the reasonableness of that, but the relationship. The invitation for us to return to the love we had for God, for Jesus, for the working of God that we had at first. That really struck me, because we can grow a bit cynical in our more senior years, perhaps. We can grow discontent as we look at others and say, what are you doing? What were you thinking? I have the danger, which I've actually been reminded of this week, of becoming the grumpy old bishop who says that, you know, when he, other ways of doing things. I have repented. I've changed direction from that. Today is a significant day in our calendar. It's the last day of winter. Spring is coming tomorrow. This is where I had a clear sense of where I wanted to land it. It's been a challenging winter in terms of weather, in terms of lots of viruses and health issues that have been floating around, and in terms of the news feeds that just get unrelenting around us. My suggestion and our response to this is to think through perhaps some of those broken cisterns of stagnant water are found in our news feeds. When we find ourselves scrolling through things, turn away from the broken systems of people who are ranting. Turn away from the broken systems, the stagnation of driving up fear of other people who are different from us. Turn away from people who are just angry at anything and everything in different directions. Be aware of all the isms that are being promoted one way or another. Maybe just turn off all that. Step away from the feeds, the scrolling, the stories, the things that make us feel angry. And where do we go with that? Well, the answer's right here in front of us. It's life. Step away and have time for people, as people. Don't worry about the labels. Don't worry about all the different things that might irritate others. Just have time for people. Enjoy one another's company. Show some kindness for those who may be irritating us. And just set aside the irritations. Recognize that life itself, each and every day, is a gift from God. And God says that the tap is not going to be turned off in life. The ever-living water is going to continue to flow. But don't turn away from those streams. One of the dangers that we have in winter is isolation. It has been a wee bit cold in the last 24 hours, in case you hadn't noticed. And yes, we want to, you know, make sure we are protected and we can be cozy in that sort of space. But don't become isolated. Keep in touch. Keep connected. And recognize this is the life that God has blessed us with. We've always different moments and seasons, but don't get locked into those systems. That'll just drag us down. That has spoken to me. My conclusion at the sermon in preparation this morning, saying to Fiona, let's go out this afternoon. We'll get some fresh air. We're not going to walk on the bleak, you know, sort of areas, but let's just go out. Have a coffee. Enjoy those moments. That is God's promise of the fresh, sustaining, life-giving water. Relating rightly, living rightly through Jesus and his way. The shalom-making work of the kingdom, which brings flourishing and is good and healthy and beautiful. through every season of life. Amen.